Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, August 6, 2011. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host. Well, this has been one hell of a week and it proved two central points. First, that Lyndon LaRouche has continued to be completely accurate with both his economic and political forecasting, as he forecast both the accelerating collapse of the economic and financial system, as well as forecasting that the British, London-centered financial interests, whose policies have caused this collapse, that those interests are going for a global fascist coup, including in the United States. And as we'll discuss on this program today, it is precisely these British imperial interests which are behind the Hitler-style coup which Obama pulled off this week, and which we have to reverse now. Now, the second point is that while the Congress left town after capitulating to the coup with barely a whimper, and as the media continues to lie about the economy, about the debt ceiling, about the political situation, and as no so-called political leaders in the country had the guts to tell you the truth, what's emerged is that the activists and members of LaRouche PAC, and particularly the slate of six candidates, have become the rallying point for the nation, the one source of leadership that's not going to give up in the face of this brutal assault on our Constitution coming out of London. As the week unfolded, some of the candidates, such as Keisha Rogers and Diane Sayre, Summer Shields, Dave Christie, all released statements that were up on the LaRouche PAC website, in which they identified the danger and discussed what we have to do to solve this crisis. And then Lyndon LaRouche himself appeared on the Alex Jones radio program, and you can probably find that if you want to hear it, and you're going to want to hear it, because what Lyndon LaRouche did on that show is outline the only solution. That first, we have to identify what happened as a Hitler-style coup, and we have to run the would-be Hitler, Barack Obama, out of office. Secondly, we have to implement Glass-Steagall, H.R. 1489. It's a bill that's in the Congress. It's something that could be done at any point now, and it's the only way to stop the bailouts and to put this country back to work. And three, move to a Hamiltonian constitutional credit system at once and extend that globally in the form of a treaty arrangement for a new Bretton Woods. Now, additionally, what Lynn discussed, and we'll take some of this up on the program today, that these are three things that have to be done. And without these three steps, humanity may not survive. But to get to the point where we can do these things, we have to have a change in the self-identity of the American people. And I'm talking right now very personally to those of you listening to this program, because many of you try to organize, you want to organize, you do things. You talk to people. But what Lynn has done in the last couple of, actually 6 weeks or so, is carry out a revolutionary reorganization of our own organization, both in terms of some aspects of structure, but primarily in terms of the quality of thinking that's required and that is specifically developed within the youth movement coming out of the basement and then put up on the website from Purcellville, and taken to the population from the candidate slate and their collaborators, that we're actually operating on a different level, a level which starts from the conception of the nature of man as not being a beast confined to sense perception, but actually defined as from the highest standpoint of being creative, as the crown of creation of a creative universe. And we'll be discussing that on this program today. Now, the good news, besides the fact that we do have a competent leadership which exists, is that our enemy is stupid and weak. They thought the population would fall in line behind the idea of a super Congress. They thought the stock market would rally because of the so-called agreement and the bailout in Europe. And what we've seen is a rout on the markets and total panic gripping the transatlantic financial elite. So they're weak and we are not. We're just few. So we've got to make sure that we few have the full power of our capability to organize. So on the program today, I'll be discussing with my guests the events of this historic week and what you, the listeners, as American patriots, can do. Joining me today will be Diana Wong, who's seen quite often on LaRouche Pack TV, sometimes on the While You Were Sleeping segment, and also doing other different videos, and also from our Midwestern deployment, working with candidate Bill Roberts in the Detroit area, Tarana Dorsey. So, Diana and Tarana, welcome to the program.
Hi. Hi. Thanks.
Now, Diana, let me begin with you, because you and I had a chance to discuss this the other night. There's a lot that's happened this last week, and sometimes it's a little difficult, especially when you have the task of going on first thing in the morning and giving people a sense of what's occurred in the last 12 hours or so. What stands out in your mind about what you might call the lessons and the importance of the events of this week?
Well, let me just start off with the bomb, essentially, that Lyndon LaRouche had dropped on an organization and on people, you know, who are aware and who are listening to LaRouche Pag and Lyndon LaRouche himself. So Monday morning, Lyndon, he got a briefing on the vote and the deal, the debt deal that was secured over the weekend at the White House with Obama, and then the vote that will take place in the House and Senate. He was briefed on what it entails, and which was the Super Congress, which was Obama overriding the U.S. Constitution to get what he wants when he couldn't get it in any other way, which is the dictatorship, the dictatorial coup that Lyndon LaRouche has been warning about for the past weeks, that it was about to happen. Congress was about to capitulate to a dictator, to pass this bill. So he made in clear terms that if this were to go through, that we would have lost our nation. That the United States, as an institution, would be lost. And this caught us by surprise. This caught many people by surprise, but not really, because Lyndon LaRouche has been warning about Obama's Nero personality since April of 2009. If people go onto our website and they look up the statement that Lynn wrote a few weeks ago, it's titled, let me just pull it up right here, titled Drumbeats Behind Libya. Lynn warned in a very clear tone that the British Empire, the financial system, is gone. They have no other option. Their only option is to put Obama up as a dictator, to pull a coup on the United States. So I think that's clear as where we stand. I mean, there are many predicates involved, you know, Obama setting up the entitlement system of the United States, the Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, institutions up to be cut, to be eliminated. There are predicates. But the most important thing is that he passed Congress. He just did a super Congress. He violated the U.S. Constitution. And this is just the beginning of what will evolve into what we saw with Hitler in 1933, 1934, when the German parliament then passed Hitler's version of the Enabling Act, which basically said here Hitler can bypass Congress and supersede the German constitution, then do what he needs to do.
You know, Diana, I think it's important that we just spell out very clearly that she is, or that what Obama is doing, the idea that this is a Hitler coup. What is this idea of the super Congress? I mean, there's nowhere in the Constitution that it says that the Congress can delegate to a smaller portion of itself the right to determine credit currency and debt policy. This is in the Constitution itself, the task of the Congress. And I think it's really important that we make clear to people that this is probably unconstitutional, that the idea of a debt ceiling itself is dubious, and that the idea that the rating agencies can order the United States to cut its spending in order to be credible to the rating agencies, which are corrupt institutions in the first place, I think that really begins to give people a sense of what we mean when we're saying this is a dictatorship of the bankers pulling a coup against our Constitution.
Yeah. Yeah, and it makes clear that, I mean, it was revealed in a Senate hearing last month on the 27th, July 27th, a committee hearing held by Representative Capuano in the House, which revealed that not only do these rating agencies have a very, very dubious and criminal history in the United States, especially from 2007 onwards in downgrading state and municipality securities in collusion with Wall Street in London, that administration, Timothy Geithner, our Treasury Secretary, was in dialogue with David Beers of Standard & Poor's as early as March of this year to talk about the debt deal and the $4 trillion that's often cited by the Congress right now.
Well, and it's also interesting to note that yesterday in Italy, the Italian government raided the offices of Moody's and Standard & Poor's, and there's an investigation into their rigging of the rating system for the sake of downgrading the Italian bonds to not just make profit, but also to force or impose austerity on the government. And, you know, Tarana, I know we were talking about this in the organizing. Do you get a reaction from people? I'd like to know, first of all, what people are saying about our identification of this so-called debt ceiling compromise as a coup. And then secondly, to what extent are people picking up on the real criminality of these rating agencies dictating policy to a sovereign government?
Yeah. Well, I can say that if we go back to last week out here in the field, we were putting out this statement from Mr. LaRouche saying we're facing the threat of a Reichstag fire. And at that time, even last week, people were saying, yes, I know. I've been worrying about that myself. This guy is a dictator. And it was actually kind of disturbing how many people were in agreement about that with no questions asked, no real disagreement on the idea that this kind of event could happen anytime soon. And we're kind of sitting in their houses just waiting for it to happen, so it's a good thing we're out here. But then this, at the beginning of this week when this happened, when Congress came out with this and rammed this through, and that morning, Monday morning, we were out in the field leading with the idea that this is a treasonous move, this is a treasonous coup where our government is being dictated to by rating agencies, which is a foreign interest, a foreign power. And the best response, the best sign-ups that we had were people who acknowledged that immediately and wanted to move with us, especially clear on the idea that both the parties are doing the work of these foreign agencies, of this foreign power. That's something that's, I would say, the most clear of any concept right now amongst the population. The most genuine and clear sentiment amongst the most amount of people is the treasonous quality of the parties in failing to provide any real leadership in the interests of the American people right now.
Now, Tarana, let me just ask you, because Michigan has always in the past generally been fairly strong democratically because of the unions, because of the industrial workforce. Mm-hmm. And in recent years, that sort of shifted a little bit. We've got a completely crazy Republican governor in there. But I'm curious, to what extent do you find people now turning against the parties and the political class? Are you getting that overall? I realize the Obama character takes the you know, people are angry at the president because he's such a fraud. But are you finding also just this sense of dismay and anger towards the process as a whole?
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean that's what I'm saying is that there is a complete rejection right now of both the parties, not 100%. I'm not saying that it's 100% across the board, but I would say at least, you know, 60 to 80% of the people that we're talking to, who some of them might put up an initial fight or pretend that the Republicans are some kind of alternative to Obama's dictatorship right now. But when really, you know, when spoken to frankly and said, come on, neither of these guys are working for us and you know it, most people say, yeah, I know, you're right, or, well, you got a point there. So there is a real across-the-board rejection of both parties, also on the side of the Democrats, who, where we're getting many people also coming up saying, you know what, I voted for this guy, and I'm ready to get him out. So there's a rejection of the parties and a recognition that they are, in the most important questions of principle and of policy, they are working together, that a policy of the bailouts of trillions of dollars for foreign banks combined with trillions of dollars of budget cuts being rammed through unconstitutionally are the most important questions that determine the parties, and that they agree on those two points. That there's no fight as a body of a party being put up against those policies.
Sure, and I think, Diana, this is one of the things that you're working on to present with the LPAC TV, because in a sense what Tarana just said is totally clear. They are spending trillions of dollars, creating trillions of dollars of new debt to give the banks the ability to prop up their completely worthless assets. And there's not a penny, not only not a penny for physical production in new credit, but they're also now cutting in at what's already a small safety net, and a safety net which is beleaguered. And you look at Michigan, you look at Texas, California, they're cutting schools, they're cutting hospitals. For what? To bail out these banks. So I know that we've been discussing this a lot in Purcellville on how to actually communicate this effectively. And what are your thoughts on that?
Well, we do have, I mean, just to plug our website here, we do have multiple developments in video presentation format and in written format from the web team here in LaRouche on how to actually treat these issues, because it's not rocket science. It's not very complicated to understand that Wall Street and London are a bunch of criminals. It's not difficult. People won't disagree with you if you said that to bail them out, to bail them out using American taxpayers' money, putting the nation on the track of hyperinflation, to bail out these financiers, to bail out these derivatives, you know, whatever you would call them, is criminal. And we have a president and a capitulating Congress whose only agenda right now is to do that, whose only agenda right now is to serve this foreign power. And I would like just to highlight briefly the tradition, the legacy of Wall Street in London. Right? We're, in a sense, we're not calling them fascists. They themselves have proven themselves to be fascists. You go back to what happened during World War II, right? Wall Street and London, the people, the financial elites, you know, the Morgans, etc., they were bankrolling Mussolini and Hitler in Europe, while at the same time they were pulling a coup against President Roosevelt here in the United States. On our website, very soon we will be featuring a presentation which is history through the treasonous history behind Wall Street in London, how historically in the United States they've been operating, they've been assassinating presidents, creating dictators like Obama, for example, to destroy the United States. In the case that we will be presenting, the specific case is how Wall Street, how Wall Street had bankrolled the basically the what do you call them?
You're talking about the Liberty League?
Liberty League, yes. Sorry, yeah. The Liberty League. In basically, yeah, bankrolling the Liberty League in trying to create this militia army to go to Washington and overthrow the government. And this was during the whole fascist movement that was happening overseas in Europe. So,
well, and of course, what is important about this is that the fascist movement in Europe was also funded by fascists in the United States, like Prescott Bush and Averill Harriman. And so just as today we have a transatlantic fascist grouping that's centered around Wall Street and the city of London, what you're describing is exactly the same force back then.
Yeah, that's what we're talking about. And the rating agencies, the institutions receiving the bailouts right now who have their hands behind Obama, they're the exact same forces. They're the exact same people. And there is no reason. As a matter of fact, we should create what FDR created, a PCORA commission, to go into Wall Street, march into Wall Street, and haul them out and throw them in prison.
And, Tarana, from your sense in the organizing, I assume that a lot of the people who are talking to would be more than happy to see those kinds of investigations going on. I mean, we had the Angelides report, the Levin-Coburn report, but these fell way short of what was done by PCORA in 1933.
Oh, yeah. Well, actually, I wanted to jump on that because although that is a definite strong sentiment amongst many people here, I would say that there's a unified hatred and justified hatred for the partisan game, the partisan politics, and what Obama is doing, but there's a real confusion amongst people around what the solutions are right now. And that manifests itself in various ways, but one of them is the opinion or the belief that FDR was, you know, did terrible things and that we've got to cut people right now. And, you know, there's various expressions of the confusion, but I think that it's so important to emphasize the role that FDR played and that his enemies were what you're describing. They were this monetarist system. They were in Wall Street in the city of London. It was the Harriman brothers and others that were involved in financing Hitler. So, but the question of the PCORA Commission is crucial right now because if we want to be able to begin to rebuild our economy and our country, we've got to clean out these Wall Street agencies. And that's something that, like I was saying, there's not much disagreement on that. I think there just needs to be more organizing around who the real enemy is, that we have to know our enemy. And our enemy is not some mythical Social Security, you know, welfare mom collecting everyone's extra money or what other, you know, mythical ideas are out there. Our enemy is this system, this monetarist system of empire, which manipulates and controls our institution of government because we've let them get to that point.
Well, you're listening to The LaRouche Show on Saturday, August 6, 2011. I should announce that this is actually being taped earlier because of a conflict on Saturday. So if you want to send in questions, you can do so, but they won't be taken up live on the program since the program will have been recorded before you got your questions in. But every week on The LaRouche Show, we're taking up these kinds of issues, and you know, a major part of what we're trying to do is to get you engaged in a dialogue, to get our supporters and people who agree with LaRouche but think it's too hard to talk to people, to get rid of your fears and get into the fight, get into the organizing process, because this is really what we have to do if we're going to win this war, is engage more people. But we do have a leadership capability right now. And Diana, I'd like you to talk a little bit about what's going on now with the idea of the LPAC reorganization so that the website and the slate of six represent a kind of unified capability.
Well, people are familiar, and people who aren't, I'll just go through it briefly. The slate of six LaRouche Democrats, they came out as a slate of six candidates, actually over a year ago, to represent an alternative to the leadership already existing in the Congress, the cowards, the traitors, you know, whatever you want to call them, that dominated the Congress. They came out as an alternative. And right now, what we want to make of this group of six is, I mean, in essence, a new party of leadership that people can rally around, that they represent political and scientific and developmental ideas that will transform this nation. So It's really funny. Actually, maybe I shouldn't call them a party because the point has been made that even calling yourself, you know, associating yourself with a party will get people to immediately cringe right now because of what they see with a party affiliation right now. But what we want to do is make the slate of six the face of what LaRouche and LaRouche PAC represents, which is Glass-Steagall, the passage of Glass-Steagall, which is right now in the House, which will be the first step to reorganizing this entire system. The separation of commercial, legitimate debts from non-legitimate debts and from things that we have today in Wall Street. A deregulated financial system where people can, you know, resell and sell and then package a mortgage a million times over to make money and to now demand bailouts from the government. That aspects of banking will be completely separated, and we will take back money. The next step that will be represented by the slate of six would be, okay, now that we have a reorganized system, financial system, credit system, what do we do? Where do we put American credit into? We put it into development. We put it into giving people productive jobs again, giving the young generation today, which has no prospect of a future, giving them a future. Starting with programs like the NOAPA, the North American Water and Power Alliance, which is a humongous project which will demand the highest technology, the highest skill level to transport clean water throughout the North American continent. Simultaneously revamp our extraterrestrial imperative. Bring back manned spaceflight. Obama has killed it. Bring back manned spaceflight and all that entails. So that's the angle. That's the agenda of the slate of six and LaRouche PAC right now, because that's the solution. People are dismayed and angry at Obama. They see the Constitution being torn apart. A dictatorial coup is underway, and Obama can, you know, he's already got the mustache on him. He can be the new dictator very soon. People know that. That's very visceral. What people need to do is realize what they have to work towards to, not just, you know, be a part-time conspirophile, not just criticize the Congress and Obama and lament the fact that our nation is going down the toilet, but actually fight for Glass-Steagall and fight for the future generations of our nation.
And, Tarana, I want to come back to you. I actually have two things I want to bring up with you. First, I'd like you to pick up on what Diana was just talking about in terms of how you organize people to actually see themselves not as victims or weaklings, but actually see themselves as creators. But before I get to that, I just would like you to give our listeners a sense of what you've seen since you've been in the Midwest in terms of the breakdown, the poverty, the effects of this collapse, and in physical terms and also emotional terms. I assume it's very obvious to you, having just come in recently.
Yeah, it's quite devastating. The city of Detroit itself is a pretty depressing place to be. Not many people go there because it's been completely devastated. I'm sure people are probably familiar with some of the figures about the amount of real estate there that's for lease and commercial. I think it's 40% of the commercial space is for lease. Most of the infrastructure is completely collapsed. But it's the whole area here, it was pretty amazing to me because I've never really been organizing in the Midwest or even in the Midwest before the last couple months or last half a year or so. And one of the things that was very striking to me is most of the small towns around Detroit all are very heavily agriculture-based, but they're also manufacturing. They're all feeder factories and small parts manufacturers for the auto sector or for some kind of industrial manufacturing capability. And most of these small towns, that was their sole employer or one of the few employers for the majority of the town. That's what, you know, what made the place tick. And a lot of these places are nearly ghost towns or abandoned or completely collapsed. The downtown, little downtown strips are completely empty because most of these people were laid off or left when these companies left or when their company shut down. And you can see it with the agriculture and what's been happening with the farmers, especially in this last year where, you know, because of the wild weather, they've had such difficulty getting their crops in the ground because of the flooding and the rains here. So, you know, people are being pretty devastated here. Also with the case of the teachers and the Detroit public school system where they were offered, you know, 3,000, they're putting out 3,000 pink slips for most of the teachers in the Detroit public school system. And now with these fascist governors like Schneider coming in, it's complete austerity. We're now, they're sending a financial manager to come dictate to the cities and the townships the cuts that have to be made with no real choice.
There have been reports that in Detroit you're almost going to have double the number of students per classroom that you had last year.
Yep.
Well, now, when you see this devastation, and it's, you know, from, if you think about the end of World War II, from the Franklin Roosevelt policies, where Detroit was the arsenal of democracy, the war was won in part because of the capability of the American productive worker to ensure the physical production. And, of course, we had Glass-Steagall implemented, we had a credit policy from Washington, so everything that you know of the American system was in place, and Detroit grew and became an industrial center with the arts, with education, and so on. Now we look a half century later, and we see it as a rust heap with you know, cities like Grand Rapids and Flint, where they're tearing down whole city blocks and letting them go fallow or farming them, but not really farming, just with rake and a hoe. So how do you communicate to people who are going through this profound demoralization where everything they grew up, the older generation, everything they grew up with is gone, and then the younger generation, which doesn't really know the productive side, how do you communicate to them this question of the challenge to reorganize the country and do it as productive citizens of a republic?
Well, I would say there's kind of three responses we get in the organizing, and then I'll answer your question directly. But we get a grouping of people who have the response of, well, we have till the next election's coming up soon, we can get somebody else in. Or the other side of it is, well, you'll never be able to do it, you'll never be able to change anything because these guys are always corrupt and look how bad it's gotten and you haven't been able to do anything and what has LaRouche done and all this kind of, you know, this kind of pessimism. And then you have another grouping who's just getting ready for chaos to hit. And, you know, when you organize around Obama being a dictator, they say, oh, I know, that's why I'm getting my gun and my freeze-dried food and I'm going to be going to Arizona and we're going to hole up there and get ready for the chaos to
come out. We
got
a cave in New Mexico.
Exactly. And then there's a third grouping who said, you know, who recognizes what we're doing and is more ready to move with us. But I'd say for all of those people, the real decisive factor in organizing and in moving them and presenting the leadership is appealing to a quality that used to drive our nation, which is the sentiment that you're not just living for your own life, but that you're living to contribute something to the generations after you. Perhaps your family, yes, but more than just your family, for the entire generation of people that are going to be coming after you're long gone. And that really that is the only idea that's going to drive and move people to fight with everything they have right now, given the situation, to what extent, you know, they have a full understanding of everything that's going on or not, we do have a clear urgency to the situation, and we are representing a clear program, a clear policy program of solutions, which, if implemented, as Diana went through, can begin to revive and redevelop our nation. But really, it's that fight on the question of the identity of the individual and what is your commitment? Is your commitment for yourself and, you know, these last few years you have of life to hold on and try to enjoy it as much as you can, or, you know, struggle to survive as long as you can for yourself? Or are you going to fight on a higher level for something that is an idea that cannot be killed but has to be fought for to be implemented? And that's really that's the level on which we're able to move people right now, to the extent we are, is to awaken that humanity in people and start to give them a sense of why it's worth fighting for the human species. As LaRouche was making the point in the weekly report on Wednesday, which I would encourage anyone who hasn't seen it to look at on our website and to watch, we have to start to ask ourselves, why are human beings special? Why are they unique? And what is required to allow for the continued survival of the human species? Not just my country or my family, but the human race. Because the United States has played a crucial role in ensuring that in the best of our history. So how do we continue that?
Well, and this was the central theme of the conference I just came back from a little while ago in Germany, in Rüsselsheim, where the question really, it's an interesting point, and I'd like your thoughts on this, Diana, because you're in a certain kind of situation where you have to think about this every day, which is, it's one thing to talk about creativity, but it's another thing to be creative and to demonstrate those principles. And I think what you were just talking about, Tarana, the weekly report, especially this last one, but even over the last several weeks, you get a sense of an ongoing discussion process, which is the essence of creative activity. And this is what was the real eye-opener in Rüsselsheim, was not just that people were talking about it, but they were being creative. And I know, Diana, this is in the work that we do, where you're, in a sense, a talking head. How do you do something other than just present facts? How do you actually inspire in other people a sense of that higher quality of humanity? So how have you guys been looking at that from the work in Purcellville?
Well, in a sense, I mean, the question that Tarana raised is actually where people should start. Because, you know, I mean, let's ask ourselves, what makes human beings so special that we deserve to escape extinction, which all other forms of life, all other animal life, will and have experienced? Like, what makes us so special? People should ask that question. Because, I mean, if you look at the history of any life form on Earth, everything is inherently creative. Let me just say this. The second law of thermodynamics, the law of entropy, is baloney. It doesn't exist in the physical universe. If you look at plant life, we're not even talking about, you know, animal life. You look at plant life and its evolutionary history on this planet, it's always been an upward trend, right? We've moved out of the ocean. I mean, but the plants have moved out of the oceans. They've moved onto land. You know, it was devastating at first, and then they had the oxygen crisis, which was very devastating. But they persisted, and then they went from ferns to fruit-bearing plants, and now they're a crucial element in the entire water cycle, the entire atmosphere of our planet. That's creativity. And that's creativity defying circumstances, defying difficult circumstances, and reaching a higher and higher state of existence. Now, animals do that, plants do that, but that's more built into its structure. Human beings, the reason why we're so special, the reason why we don't have to go extinct in order for a higher form of ourselves to come into being, is because we can willfully make that evolutionary leap without having to sacrifice ourselves. We can willfully make that evolutionary leap through new discoveries, through upshifts in technologies, through upshifts in inventions. That's what human beings do. And oftentimes, it's not for our own sake. The best of representatives in the human history have done it for the sake of humanity in the future, for posterity, to make life easier for. There's a lot of discussion on how do we make Africa a better place. There's a lot of discussion on how we can make, third world countries a better place. The best thing we can do for them is to provide the conditions where they too can make the same discoveries that people of a successful first world nation can do. Because that's the only thing that will sustain the human race is creativity. That's our jewel. That's it. Nothing else.
And just picking up on what you're talking about, when Lyndon LaRouche was on the Alex Jones show the other day, most people know Alex Jones as a hard-nosed, tough guy, connect the dots, show the conspiracy. And Lynn, in his discussion, after going through the coup danger and talking about what we still have to do, how we can turn adversity into an advantage, Lynn talked exactly about what the two of you just brought up in terms of creativity and what is the nature of man. And Lynn said that, for example, in this question of Africa, this is the quality, the specific quality of human love, that we have to love our fellow human beings. And this is not what you ordinarily hear on the Alex Jones show. But you could see the effect of this as Alex was moved by this and the listeners were moved by this. And, I think on the one hand, you've got to have this hard-nosed quality of being able to say what Obama did on Monday and Tuesday was a Hitler-style coup, with him in the role of Hitler, being directed by these London networks, committed to killing 6 billion people on the planet. Now, in saying that, at the same time, you have to be able to show people that they possess the capability to fight that, and that higher capability is both this question of immortality, which is really the principle of love of mankind. And I guess, Tarana, I'm sure a lot of our listeners who like to hear about this nevertheless run up against a question of their own rage and their own anger at what they've lost. And how do you help people overcome that to actually think about the human race as a lovable species, but because of its being trapped in believing such things as a second law of thermodynamics, is about to wipe itself out?
I think most people have a pretty deep, most people, there's a few exceptions, maybe Prince Philip and Obama, but most people have a pretty deep-rooted sense of love for people. I think where the real struggle comes in is giving people the courage to discuss these kinds of ideas with others. Prince, I think the Alex Jones show is a perfect example, as you were bringing up, because, a lot of people maybe like LaRouche for certain policies he discusses or certain ideas, but when it comes to discussing something like the role of the human species or what is creativity with other people, that really is a scary idea to most people, just because of the fear of popular opinion or that people are too stupid or they'll think you're crazy. But if you look at the results of the kind of organizing that Mr. LaRouche himself did on the Alex Jones show, and we already had several singularities here of people who had heard LaRouche, or some who had never heard of LaRouche, who heard him on the Alex Jones show and called in our office and want to organize a town meeting. Others who had seen us on the street before, didn't have time to pull over, but had listened to the interview and then pulled over and did a $100 contribution to our political action committee. So that shows power of ideas when you have courage to go with them and when you've done the work to be able to communicate them effectively. And I would say, just as a last point on that, to give people some strength to take these ideas out themselves and talk with other people is the idea of having the passion to do this, the passion to fight for improving the continent of Africa, as Diana brought up, or for giving those future generations the conditions of life and better than what we have now. That passion isn't just, it's not a feeling, it's not an emotion. That's something that gets, you know, as put across in the culture a lot these days, that passion is, you know, what you feel for playing sports, or, you know, what gets you excited every morning once you drink your coffee or something like that. But the real sense of passion comes from this, having the identity of being able to change the way people think for the better based on truthful and noble ideas. And that's something that requires a lot of work on the part of the individual and a lot of courage. And that's clearly what somebody like LaRouche embodies, but that's something that is accessible to everyone. And these times really require from everyone who can muster that kind of courage.
Well, and it's very interesting, because what you just discussed is this question of the interrelationship between scientific discovery, the state of mind required to discover new principles, and this question of the love of mankind, and one of the things that connects it is the ability to communicate ideas, which can't happen simply in a verbal realm, that you, in a sense, have to use ways of breaking out of the kinds of thinking that most people have that have been shaped by sense certainty and literalness, and most people don't even believe the extent, don't even know the extent to which their beliefs are shaped by such things as the second law of thermodynamics, sense certainty, and so on. And, you know, Diana, you're working in a medium that is the video medium, which in some ways is limited by the, at least in the way it ordinarily functions, to be information as opposed to creativity-oriented. And I'm wondering to what extent you think we've been able to bring these ideas into the video work, because I know what Lynn is saying is that our future depends on reaching this generation of the 25 to 35-year-olds, which don't read newspapers but tend to get their ideas from video-type media. So I wonder what, if you can say something about that.
Well, I think what we're striving for on our website is, I mean, there is a lot of axioms to break through. There's a lot of things people expect in the culture when they, you know, watch a video, watch a news report. They expect to get, you know, information. They expect to get informed. And usually what happens afterwards is that, okay, they turn it off and they go smoke a joint or do something degenerate that totally contradicts, you know, what they just heard or what they're motivated by. And the only tool at our disposal to counteract that type of reaction, which is usually the case, is classical drama, where your presentation actually grips people to a point where you hold them accountable for their actions. Where, as opposed to other news sources, other, you know, documentary groups, whatever you would call them, as opposed to them, who oftentimes are not accountable for what they say, they just report it to you and you take the information. What we do as a website, as a political action committee, is that we hold people accountable for what they need to do. For what they need to do, we hold ourselves accountable, so we hold them accountable. And I mean, I'd just like to put out a call to our listeners, to our organizers, that they, if they are in a position where they can organize, where they have networks either socially, among their neighbors, they're involved in political groups, that they should make a curriculum out of our website and distribute it to their friends and networks and neighbors, family members. That's what we have to do. We're trying to create a mass movement, because without a mass movement, Obama is going to succeed in getting his dictatorship, and then that will be the end of it. So in a sense, I mean, in a very crucial sense, it's very timely. The clock we're operating on is moving very fast, and we're doing our best here on our website to produce the right ideas and the concepts. And it's up to you guys, the listeners, the people who identify with what we're saying, to put it out, to get it out as far and wide, to organize, to make yourself a black sheep and organize your networks.
And I'd like to just second that call you made, Diana, to our listeners who, if you haven't been on the website recently, the amount of material that's going up is increasing. The quality is improving. We're about to have a whole series of new pieces going up on the scientific questions. There's a new one from Jason Ross on Riemann. There'll be more coming up. And if you're not making the LaRouche Pack your homepage, then you're missing out on the revolution. And if you miss out on this revolution, we are going to have a fascist dictatorship. Now, we have, about 7 minutes or so left in the program. And, Tehran, I'd like to come back to you and this question of the coup. What should people be telling their friends? Just give them a sample of if they want to organize, what should they tell their friends about what just happened and what they have to do?
Well, I would start with they can reference the leaflet that the candidate Bill Roberts of the sixth Democratic slate that we have put out recently on the website, called "If You Plan on Surviving, Plan on Fighting," which I think is a good way to succinctly describe the situation right now. They can reference that in making the point that neither party is representing the American people, which I don't think they'll get much disagreement on, that Obama has used this so-called budget bill discussion as a way to ram through austerity cuts in a Hitler style, which is creating a basically unconstitutional body of six Democrats and six Republicans who will be now dictating directly the cuts from, you know, dictated by rating agencies and Wall Street. And that if they want to fight, if they want to figure out a way to fight, they should, as Diana is saying, get on our website. That's a good first step. That can constantly be referenced, and people should keep coming back to that, because there's always more. There's always more in-depth material. There's always more they can figure out and better equip themselves with. But they should come out in the real world. Come out. We have plenty of town hall meetings. If you're in an area where we don't have a office or a headquarters, you can start a group. Start having meetings. Use the website as the substance of your meetings, where you can, you know, play a video from the website and then have some discussion. And have your friends write checks out to LaRouche Pack or contribute whatever they can right now. And then you can keep in touch with representatives, other organizers of LaRouche Pack in the nearest office, to have a sense of what kind of events or organizing can be done in your area. But there's plenty to do. I think if people have the intention to do it, they can, you know, when there's a will, there's a way. They can find a way to do something right now.
Well, and Bill's headline came right from what Lynn said, which is that if you want to survive, you have to fight. And I think we have a lot of people who think they're survivors, and they think they're fighting when they say they've got beef jerky in the basement, a little bit of water, and a machine gun down there. But that's fighting stupidly. The point that I think we have to make, and I'll turn this back over to you, Diana, to make it, but the point is our enemies are weak. You know, you have the completely hilarious self-satire of Barroso, the European Community President, coming out yesterday as now Spain and Italy are about to need bailouts. They've come up with one bailout after another, and it's never enough. And so Barroso says, we have to show them that we've got this thing under control by increasing our bailout fund from 750 billion euros to 2 trillion euros. That will show them how solid we are. When in fact, it shows the opposite. It proves that all they have in mind is more and more bailouts, and they're just going to need more and more bailouts. So our enemies are weak, and I think this question of our forces having to have a self-conscious, willful determination to fight is the key. So, Diana, I turn it over to you.
Well, across the Atlantic with the financial breakdown here in the United States, the financial breakdown in Europe and really elsewhere in Russia, in Asia, the only solution lies in the first step of passing Glass-Steagall. Passing Glass-Steagall, H.R. 1489, which is right now sitting in the U.S. Congress, gathering co-sponsors. I mean, in a sense, we can't rely on our congressmen to keep, you know, accumulating co-sponsors and, you know, cross our fingers from sitting at our homes, you know, in front of our computers, to do the right thing. We have to build the momentum for them. We have to supply the courage to those few in the Congress and in leading institutions who will be willing, who are in a position, who have the responsibility, as a matter of fact, to do the right thing for the country. And that goes in line with what Tarana just brought up, that you can't rely on something good to happen. You can't wait for the next revolution. There's not going to be a next revolution for a very, very long time if Obama succeeds in becoming dictator of the United States. You will have to make the first move. Get on our website, watch our videos, get educated, contact a local headquarters of LaRouche PAC, and put yourself out there. There should be no resistance. At this point, there's nothing to lose. We're on the verge of losing our lives, of losing humanity. So there's really nothing more to lose. And I think what LaRouche said this during the course of this week, in light of this coup pulled by Obama, is that Congress essentially violated their oath, the oath that they paid to the United
States. Right.
When they became congressmen, they violated they basically trashed their allegiance to the nation. But we, as citizens, we few haven't.
I think, Diana, we're going to have to stop at that because we're out of time, but that's the important point, that we have not violated our oath to the Constitution. And I appreciate having the two of you on, and I think this is hopefully a discussion that's very useful for people out there who want to organize. As Diana said, you have nothing to lose. And I would add one more point to what she said. Contribute money to LaRouche PAC. Your money's going to be worth nothing if there's another bailout, which is where we're headed. You're not going to have any money because of the collapse of the physical economy. So while you have it, use it to help us win this war. So Tarana and Diana, thank you very much for being with us today. You've been listening to The LaRouche Show, and we will be back next Saturday with the weekly edition of The LaRouche Show. Thank you very much.